spot's kind of longer. They're handing out tickets, and I was one of the first to hear, but they got
serious. Man, what happened was, I think they had 750, 800 tickets. I'm not sure who it was to the hospital. It was a first come, first serve kind of thing. Whether you had a ticket or not, at 7:30, if you weren't in your seat, in your assigned seat on your ticket, 7:30. And that's what happened. That's why I was like, over in a matter of minutes. But I drove, I got tickets out. So at 7:30, it was just free for all. That's what happened. A lot of folks are in the same situation. They're sitting downstairs and watching the big screen.
Oh, it's the
same effect. Yeah.
Okay.
There it is. It's not the same effect, but at least you get to listen to the lecture. Maybe the question and answer session's coming on. I was trying to get him to talk past 8:30, but he was for about 10 minutes late starting, too, I think.
Yeah, it's like a certain time. Just the balcony upstairs disturbs itself. So I'll just go through and check it out.
That's probably not going to get there.
Yeah.
At least two should be up.
All right.
At least two are.
Thanks.
She asked only that she should be allowed to go into the mountains for 2 months to bewail her virginity. At the end of this time, she neatly returned, and Jephthah caught her. God did not see fit to intervene on this occasion. God's monumental rage whenever his chosen people flirted with a rival god resembles nothing so much as sexual jealousy of the worst kind. And again, it should strike a modern moralist as far from good role model material. The temptation to sexual infidelity is readily understandable, even to those who do not succumb, and it's a staple of fiction and drama from Shakespeare to bedroom farce. But the apparently irresistible temptation to whore with foreign gods is something we moderns find harder to empathize with. To my naive eyes, thou shalt have no other gods but me.
And that girl crying downstairs, I have no idea what's going on there. Apostasy?
Or her ass.
Maybe.
Or her ox. Yet, throughout the Old Testament, with the same predictable regularity as in bedroom farce, God had only to turn his back for a moment, and the children of Israel would be off and at it with Baal on some trollop of a graven image. Or on one calamitous occasion, a golden calf.
But catharsis for sure.
And then follows a section on Moses, which I'm going to cut. Go on to the end of the Moses section. The ethnic cleansing begun in the time of Moses is brought to bloody fruition in the book of Joshua, a text remarkable for the bloodthirsty massacres it records and the xenophobic relish with which it does so. As the charming old song exultantly has it, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho and the walls came a-tumbling down. There's none like good old Joshua at the battle of Jericho. Good old Joshua didn't rest until they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword. Joshua 6:21. Yet again, theologians will protest it didn't happen. Well, no, the story has it that the walls came tumbling down at the mere sound of men shouting and blowing horns. So indeed, it didn't happen. But that is not the point. The point is that whether true or not, the Bible is held up to us as the source of our morality. And the Bible story of Joshua's destruction of the Lebensraum of Jericho and the invasion of the Promised Land in Germany is morally indistinguishable from Hitler's invasion of Poland or Saddam Hussein's massacres of the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs. The Bible may be an arresting and poetic work of fiction, but it is not the sort of book you should give your children to form their morals. As it happens, the story of Joshua in Jericho is the subject of an interesting experiment in child morality by the Israeli psychologist George Tamarin. Tamarin presented to more than 1,000 Israeli schoolchildren aged between 8 and 14 the book of Joshua's account of the Battle of Jericho. He then asked the children a simple moral question. Do you think Joshua and the Israelites acted rightly or not? They had to choose between A, total approval, B, partial approval, and C, total disapproval. The results were polarized. 66% gave total approval and 26% total disapproval, with rather fewer, 8% in the middle, with partial approval. Here are three typical answers from the total approval A group. In my opinion, Joshua and the sons of Israel acted well. And here are the reasons. God promised them this land and gave them permission to conquer. If they would not have acted in this manner or killed anyone, then there would be the danger that the sons of Israel would have assimilated among the Goyim.
A little disappointed. He's reading straight from the book.
One reason being that God commanded him to exterminate the people so that the tribes of Israel will not be able to assimilate amongst them and learn their bad ways. Joshua did good because the people who inhabited the land were of a different religion. And when Joshua killed them, he wiped their religion from the earth. The justification for the genocidal massacre by Joshua is religious in every case. Even those in category C who gave total disapproval did so in some cases for backhanded religious reasons. One girl, for example, disapproved of Joshua's conquering Jericho because in order to do so, he had to enter it. I think it is bad since the Arabs are impure, and if one enters an impure land, one will also become impure and share their curse. Tamarin ran a fascinating control group in his experiment. A different group of 168 Israeli children were given the same text from the book of Joshua, but with Joshua's own name replaced by General Lin, and Israel replaced by a Chinese kingdom 3,000 years ago. Now the experiment gave opposite results. Only 7% approved of General Lin's behavior, and 75% disapproved. In other words, when their loyalty to Judaism was removed from the calculation, the majority of the children agreed with the moral judgments that most modern humans would share. Joshua's action was a deed of barbaric genocide. But it all looks different from a religious point of view, and the difference starts early in life. It was religion that made the difference between children condemning genocide and condoning it. Do those people who hold up the Bible as an inspiration to moral rectitude have the slightest notion of what is actually written in it? The following offenses merit the death penalty according to Leviticus 20. Cursing your parents, committing adultery, making love to your stepmother or your daughter-in-law, homosexuality, marrying a woman and her daughter, bestiality, and to add injury to insult, the unfortunate beast is to be killed too. You also get executed, of course, for working on the Sabbath. The point is made again and again throughout the Old Testament. In Numbers 15, the children of Israel found a man in the wilderness gathering sticks on the forbidden day. They arrested him and then asked God what to do with him. As it turned out, God was in no mood for half measures that day. And the Lord said unto Moses, the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp. And all the congregation brought him without the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. Did this harmless gatherer of firewood have a wife and children to grieve for him? Did he whimper with fear as the first stones flew and scream with pain as the fusillade crashed into his head? What shocks me today about such stories is not that they really happened. They probably didn't. What makes my jaw drop is that people today should base their lives on such an appalling role model as Yahweh. And even worse, that they should bossily try to force the same evil monster with a fact or fiction. on the rest of us.